I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of January 21st, 2011. Get ready. Fannie and Freddie are cracking down. We'll have that story in a moment. And you know, lots of us dream of the day we'll stop working, but we don't spend a whole lot of time on what we'll do next.
People find out that quote-unquote retirement isn't what it's cracked up to be. We've had numerous stories of people coming here after 6 months of golf and saying, my handicap's only got that one stroke and I'm bored to tears.
Enter the retirement coach. And here's one idea that may be on its way to retirement: booking your own airfare online.
I think we're going back to the 1970s when you had to call every airline separately.
Oh, geez. I hope not. That story and more coming up. But first, I'm starting to wonder if and when the housing market will stop being a lead story in this country. But until that happens, new rules that went into effect on January 1st say that if you don't get the best terms on your mortgage, your lender has to tell you. And they have to tell you why. But not all the new rules are going the way of the consumer. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are getting tough on anyone with any sort of question mark in their finances. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has our story.
It's hard to find a more financially prepared home buyer than Arthur Chadwick. He and his wife closed on a home in Los Angeles earlier this month after spending years watching the market, paying down debts, squirreling money away, and generally doing everything right.
We had paid off our student loan before even thinking about houses. We had a solid 20% down. We really had a very realistic idea of how much we could spend. And no amount of bullying was going to get us to go above that. We were both just mule-headed enough.
And soon, even good credit risks like the Chadwicks will also need an eagle eye for the details of the mortgage. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are getting stricter. The government-backed entities buy mortgages from lenders, and when they impose a fee on lenders, it gets passed along to homebuyers. In coming months, Fannie and Freddie will raise fees on loans they deem risky. Cameron Findlay is chief economist at LendingTree.
Fannie may look at this to say, okay, you know, what costs are we going to incur by guaranteeing these loans?
The fees will range from 0.25% of the total loan up to 3.5%. They're based on two factors: the size of the down payment and the borrower's credit score. Findlay says even loans to borrowers with excellent credit may get dinged with fees from Fannie and Freddie.
They're now saying, not only do we have some concerns for poor credit borrowers, we're also now more closely evaluating high credit borrowers.
Risk-based fees get passed along to borrowers in one of two ways. Your lender might charge you a flat fee or might factor the fee into your interest rate. The new fees work out to about $500 more for every $100,000 borrowed. Freddie Mac points out that for a $200,000 fixed-rate mortgage, most borrowers would pay only $10 more a month. Columbia Business School's Chris Mayer says, even so,
that takes away buying power of somebody who's thinking about buying a home.
Mayer says the new penalties are too strict. He says these are not the go-go days of the housing bubble, and the loans Fannie and Freddie buy these days are more conservative and carefully vetted. Greg McBride is a senior financial analyst at Bankrate.com. His advice to minimize the impact of these new fees is to take the time you need to boost your credit score and save up enough to make as big a down payment as possible.
If you need to take 6 months or 12 months to put your best foot forward and get the best loan on the best terms, well, then go ahead and do it, because unlike during the housing boom when home prices were going up by leaps and bounds, the home prices aren't going to run away from you in the meantime.
Freddie Mac's new standards go into effect on March 1st. Fannie Mae starts charging its new fees a month later. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace Money.
After more than a year of honest-to-goodness house hunting, my husband and I found the homebuyer's version of the Holy Grail, a bank-owned property you'd actually want to live in.
Commentator and Los Angeles Times columnist Megan Dom.
This wasn't an abandoned tract house in the desert or a shack by the freeway that some fool bought at the height of the market for $500,000. This was a shockingly nice house with a shockingly below market price. It had vaulted ceilings, a nice yard, and not just a dining room, but a breakfast room. Never mind that all the money we saved is now going toward a new roof and a new heating system and a new, oh, let's not even go there. We're thrilled about the place. But here's the thing with these REO, or real estate-owned, properties. The karma is inherently bad. We know our good fortune is a direct result of someone else's hardship. The previous owner of this house had lived there for 20 years before he got foreclosed on last summer. My husband tracked him down, and it turned out he'd gotten divorced a few years back and had to buy out his wife's half of the house. The problem? He had to pay her the market price, and since this was the height of the housing bubble, the home's value had inflated to the size of a zeppelin. "But it's okay," he told my husband. "I had a good run there. I hope you guys enjoy the place as much as I did. We can't imagine we won't. But then again, life is full of things you can't imagine at first. When I was 12, we moved into the house that would effectively be my childhood home. My mother told me, rather cluckingly, that the previous owners were leaving because the parents were getting divorced. As it happened, when my parents eventually moved out, it was because they were splitting. The couple who lived there next? Well, I heard a few rumors. This is why you're supposed to burn sage or have your house blessed by a shaman, or, better yet, avoid knowing about the previous owners altogether. But amid this sea of foreclosures and short sales, those of us who've grabbed the longer end of the stick might do well to take a moment and think about the ones who've lost their hold altogether. Meanwhile, if you have to get divorced, this is the market to do it in.
Megan Dom is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. We've got a new blog going at marketplace.org/money. It's called Making Money. And right now we're featuring a guest post from blogger Jim Wang of Bargaineering.com to help you decide whether to buy or rent. Check it out and leave your thoughts. How you feeling today? Got the sniffles? Sore throat, maybe? It is that time of year when you probably know at least one person who's dealing with a cold, and they're spending a lot of money on it. Exactly how much? Close to $40 billion, according to researchers. We asked a few of our colleagues at Marketplace how much they usually spend to quash the common cold.
My kids go through a lot of the children's Motrin, so we probably purchased, you know, 3 or 4 bottles this season. It's about $8 a pop.
But I definitely do buy vitamin C drops. I eat those like candy, and those are about $4.
I got that vitamin C powder, and then I also got Alka-Seltzer Plus cold medicine. So maybe between $21 and $30.
Vitamin C stuff, vitamin D, something called wellness formula, and I probably spend about $60 a month.
All right, so we wondered what the real impact is of the common cold, especially when it comes to our wallets. Dr. Mark Fendrick of the University of Michigan looked into that price tag and joins us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So what is the kind of per person, per cold price tag? Do you have a rough estimate?
Well, as you well know, costs of cold are variable depending on it's a very quick, self-limited condition, or that it actually leads to things like a visit to the drugstore to get an over-the-counter medication, or going to the doctor, which then leads to things like prescription drugs, x-rays, and those rare instances that you actually need to be admitted for a complication such as pneumonia. So when we put the whole pie together, it adds up to an amount more than things like congestive heart failure, osteoporosis, and asthma, which seem to get a lot more attention.
Wow.
That's largely because, as you know, the common cold is the most common disease in man, and that nearly 3/4 will have a cold in the year. And if you have one, you may have two. And what is surprising, actually, even for me as a practicing primary care physician, that most people reported that a cold will last about 1 week long. And maybe more surprisingly is that up to 1/4 said that their symptoms did not go completely away until after 14 days.
Yeah, that's me. I don't think I've ever had any such thing as like a 2 or 3 day cold. And I have to tell you, I think that so many of us as employees go through something of a cost analysis ourselves when we get sick, which is if I'm away from work and I don't have decent sick leave, there's kind of a perverse incentive to go to work while you're sick, which means that you're probably going to stay sick longer and you're going to infect other people.
And coming up with our $40 billion number test, we didn't even consider the obvious thing that you just mentioned, that being the transmission potential for the common cold. I think that we typically don't measure work loss issues even when you have the illness. And in the case of the common cold, most of the work loss costs were for parents who were taking time off to spend 126 million days a year to stay home with their sick kids.
Let me ask you about what I find to be one of the biggest expenditures when I'm sick, which is that trip to the drugstore. And I don't think I usually escape that place without spending at least $50. It is really expensive to get sick.
Right, and people don't even think about the amount of money that's spent for the over-the-counter medications, which in our case were up to $3 billion a year.
Woo!
And as you know, you walk into any store, the size of the cough and cold aisle is clearly enormous because
yes.
there is a medication to treat each and every one of the symptoms of fever, cough, runny nose, headache, etc. And you could get any possible combination of therapies to treat 1, 2, 3, 4, and even 5 symptoms at the exact same time. I will say, though, that when you talk about prescription drugs, the amount of money we should spend on upper respiratory tract infections should be lower than it is because, as most people well know, we don't have an effective prevention or curative medication for these viral illnesses. And probably what your grandmother told you, hydration, rest, maybe some chicken soup, orange juice, etc., may be just as good as that $50 visit to the pharmacy window, which you mentioned.
You know, one question that comes up when I'm sick is, do I buy the brand name? You know, do I go for the NyQuil, the Benadryl, the Sudafed, or do I go for the generic that's maybe a few bucks cheaper and appears to have pretty much the same ingredients according to the box?
It does, but I'll tell you that being the father of 4 teenagers, when I try to bring home store brand Captain Crunch, I get an uproar as opposed to the name brand. So I think there is something in addition to those same ingredients to actually what people believe is the effect as opposed to what the ingredients would make up. In most of the single treatments, the generic medication, that being the active ingredient, is often the exact same as between the branded and the store brand agents.
Dr. Fendrick, what do you do when you get a cold?
I do what my grandmother told me to do, matzo ball soup and a little extra vitamin C, and understand what I learned from this very interesting study, that the common cold is not very commonly quick and over, that it could take a week, and in the case of Tess Vigeland, 2 weeks is not at all uncommon.
Dr. Mark Fendrick, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Tess.
Dr. Mark Fendrick is a practicing internist and co-director of the University of Michigan's Center for Value-Based Insurance Design.
Got a cold? Got to feel better fast.
Is your nose running?
Yes.
Sneezing? Nasal congestion?
Another cold, honey.
Oh, you look terrible.
It's the great-tasting nighttime sniffling, sneezing, coughing, aching, stuffy head fever so you can rest medicine.
It's that time of the show when we take your questions. With me once again this week is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Tess. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. I wanted to ask you about one of the headlines this week, which is that Steve Jobs has stepped away from his job.
Yeah.
Now, of course, on this show, we really don't talk about investing in individual stocks. But, you know, Apple is a big part of the stock market. In fact, I was reading in Brent Aaron's column this week in the Wall Street Journal that it accounts for more than a fifth of the NASDAQ 100. And there are 4,100 mutual funds that hold stock in Apple.
Yeah.
So indeed, we are affected by this. But what does that mean?
Well, it was a good column, and I applaud him for it. You know, here's my reaction to it. You know, I talk a lot about index funds.
Yep.
When I read that article, I took away, I said, you know what? So many people actually own index funds, but they're paying a high fee for it.
Hmm.
Because if you look, a lot of these mutual funds, they're broadly diversified. They own a lot of stocks, and Apple is one of the stars. But in a sense, you're paying an extra fee. The term that's used in the business is a closet index fund. So yes, what happens to Apple is going to affect all of us. And by the way, what happened to Apple has been affecting the valuations that are going on at Facebook. Twitter has been going up. There's a lot of excitement going on. But this is why I invest in index funds, because I can't figure this stuff out. And I just want to pay a low fee rather than pay someone a lot of money to buy Apple.
And presumably then, if you're in a very broad market-based index fund, you've got stock in hundreds of companies that even if something were to happen to Apple, it's going to be a blip on your radar.
That's absolutely right. I mean, the way I look at just what you described, that really broad-based index fund, you're essentially buying a piece of the U.S. economy.
Okay. Well, shall we hit the phones?
Oh, yes. I'm very curious what you're going to
spring on you this time.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Let's go to Nancy, and she is in Chi-Town. Hey, Nancy.
Hello.
Are you staying warm there in Chicago?
Oh, of course. It's been a little bit harsher than usual, but it really doesn't bother me as much as it seems to bother other people. I grew up in Michigan, so and whatever happens in Michigan happens in Chicago, but to a little bit greater degree.
Right.
You know, I'm not as wimpy as some of these Chicagoans.
Did you just call your fellow Chicagoans wimpy?
I did, and they know
it. Oh, you're in trouble now. So what do you do there in Chicago?
I work at, I'm a buyer at a local utility. We process wastewater.
You buy waste?
No.
We're really not going to get into potty jokes here, are we?
Well, that joke is, we're the number one business of number two.
Oh, no, you did not go there.
This is going viral real fast.
No, it's going down the toilet is what it's doing.
Oh, my gosh. Wow, I can't top that one.
Okay, well, that's just fine. That's just fine. So why don't we just push right ahead to your question?
Well, it's kind of a curse to have your mother's first name.
Oh, so you're a Nancy Jr.
I'm a Nancy Jr., yes.
Okay.
I think any kid who shares the first name of their parent can have some problems.
Why?
I've been mixed in with my mother's credit history.
Uh-oh.
And same with my brother.
Is your brother named Nancy?
No, he has the same name as my father. Har har.
Wait, so your brother is named after your dad and you're named after your mom, and you've both had what it sounds like identity problems?
Well, I'm not going to speak for my brother because I'm not sure. I have reason to believe that he has.
Huh.
But my particular issue, my mom's, she died 10 years ago. If she were alive, she'd be 70 years old. I'm 44. And for the last year and a half, couple years, I've been getting stuff from the AARP. I have been getting stuff that comes from insurance companies, life insurance companies.
A little early for all that.
Yeah, it's annoying is what it is. I'm thinking, what the hell? And or what the heck, I'm sorry. And
this is a family show now.
Yes, I have to understand. I understand this. I didn't realize the extent of the issue until a coworker who was making out Christmas cards came back to me one day and said, Nancy, you look really good for your age. She pointed me to where she found my address online, and there is my mom with my name. Now, we both have different middle names, but my name's there, but her age is there.
Wow, so this is really pervasive.
It is. I want to know how it happened. And here's another thing, too. My mom's been dead for 10 years. Why now is this all starting?
Well, Chris, I don't know that we can answer the why nows.
The why, I mean, I have a theory, which is that, you know, Tess Nancy has become so cheap for outfits to buy names.
And you're talking about basically direct marketing.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's kind of been swept up in that high-tech universe.
Okay, well, I think that's a pretty good guess.
Don't these people check their facts?
No, that would actually take some effort on their part.
That would cost money.
Well,
no.
Let me ask you this.
Uh-huh.
How much is this an annoyance, and how much is it damaging you financially? Is there
That's
any damage
what I want to know. First of all, I've created my own problems, but my mother and father together had problems.
What, financial problems?
Yes. Back in the 80s, they filed for bankruptcy. And this was when I was 21, 22.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no credit history of my own. I went to apply for a credit card about a year after their bankruptcy was finalized, and I was denied. And this is at the time when banks still talk to you in person. And the guy called me and he's like, you have a bankruptcy on your record.
But hadn't you used your own Social Security number on your application?
Yes.
Well, did you get that cleared up?
You know what? At the time, I didn't really bother, partly because I was kind of afraid of credit cards.
Right. But you don't have to have a credit card to clean up your credit report.
No.
Right.
And to clean up errors and, you know, misidentification.
Right. Well, and I didn't know how to go about it. I do have some loans through my credit union, and they say that, you know, I can clean up the credit report. It's just when it comes to my mom, my concern is, what kind of implications is this going to be for me for when I do retire? And even if my mom's stuff isn't on my credit report anymore, obviously there's information out there floating around.
Yeah. Well, you know, Chris, my first reaction to this is that Nancy is just going to have to bird dog this keep at it and, you're going to have to send notarized letters and, you know, registered mail and just keep going after this until it gets cleaned up.
Okay.
This is really identity confusion as opposed to identity theft.
Right.
Now, with identity theft, we kind of know what to do. I mean, it's a real problem, but there's a whole set of procedures. Although I do think as time continues to pass, this should become less and less an issue. But what can you do to be proactive? My main suggestion is to really monitor your credit reports.
I do all three at different points during the year.
Perfect.
That's exactly right. That's perfect. And you also have the right to write 200 words that says, I've been dealing with a problem with confusion with my mother. You know, highlight the problem.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
You can do that with each of them. And then I would create a form letter that says who you are, eliminates the identity confusion. And then if it does pop up, then you have some sort of form letter that you could send in.
And, you know, Nancy, I've actually been through this myself where I had to correct some things on my credit report. And these days, it's, you know, I agree with Chris that you need to have a form letter ready to go for when this happens. But when you go in and check your credit report, there is an online method to correct inaccuracies. And you can basically mark boxes where, you know, and say, basically, this is not me. This is not my address. This is not where I worked, that sort of thing.
Oh, all right.
So does that help you out, Nancy Jr.?
I haven't called that in a long time. Yes, it does. Thank you very, very much.
You're most welcome. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
All right, Chris. And next up, we've got Kathleen from your neck of the woods, St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello.
So what do you do?
Aside from staying warm, I'm a clinical educator. I work with the clinicians. Our clinicians work with kids who have high medical support needs, and I try to give them information on how to care for people from all different backgrounds, whether it's a different culture or someone who needs interpretation help.
Do you work in a school or in a hospital?
No, it is a home care company.
And what kind of age are you talking about?
These are pediatric, so, you know, just
young
right
kids.
After birth until some of them have stayed on our service until they're young adults.
Is there anything in the health care bill that deals with this kind of thing?
You know, they have been concerned about the degree to which healthcare addresses children's issues.
Mm-hmm.
And there is information in the healthcare bill about one section of my job, which is about plain language. And I'm sure you've run into that in your areas, whether it's financial information, being financially literate.
Right. Sure.
There's an effort in legislation, including the healthcare legislation, to promote health literacy.
It's trying to keep things simple.
That is correct.
Yeah. That would be great for all of us, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
In all areas of our lives.
It.
Yeah, technology, everything.
Right. Well, we will try to keep it simple. How can we help you out today?
Well, my question is, I am 63 years of age. I hope, and it appears 5 years of employment ahead of me. But for the first time in my life, I'm thinking about purchasing a home.
Hmm.
And I honestly don't know if at this point in my life, that is a good decision to take on that amount of financial debt.
Why would you want to?
That's a good question. I keep asking myself. There's a few things. I feel like my window is closing in terms of, I know I have already been approved for a loan, but I think as I grow closer to retirement, that may not be an option. Of course, you know, the low interest rates, low prices.
Can I ask what you're paying now in rent?
$675.
$675 a month?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Why would you ever move?
Well, I'm not sure. There's things about the situation. I've been there 30 years, and somebody pointed out to me, golden rule is after 30 years, it's time for change. It's every 30 years, you should probably change. And I live in a student community. I live right by the university. I'm sort of tired of all the things that come with that.
Animal house?
Like beer bottles on the lawn every day?
That is correct. And and with that low rent, you know, I don't ask for a whole lot of improvements.
Right.
It'd be nice to actually, you know, have some control over my place. And this particular house fell into my lap.
Oh, so you're already looking at a house?
Yes, I am.
What kind of down payment would you have?
20%, and that would be about $42,000, I think.
So it's 63 years old. The question here is really whether it's worth it for her to, presumably, are you looking at a 30-year mortgage?
Well, I was looking at a 30-year because the payments would be smaller.
Right.
And my concerns, of course, are the opportunity cost.
Yep.
It will require me to continue to work full-time. It sort of removes my option of if I ever would want to move after I retire.
Kathleen, I think you've just answered your own question,
haven't
you?
Right then. It's just, I mean, you're giving up an awful lot of financial flexibility. Even if you accelerate your payments, you know, the earliest you could probably pay it off is, say, 10 years. But that then means that there's an awful lot of money that you have concentrated on this one asset.
Right.
So I'd be really wary.
If I were to hold it, say, for 6 or 7 years, say if we had a 1% increase in the price of the home each year, is that something to think about that I would be able to get out from under in 6 or 7 years?
Kathleen, I would say that the lesson of the last 2 years is that there is zero guarantee of that.
Right. So, but even if you did operate under that assumption, that's still 6, 7 years where you've tied up a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
You have what people want at age 63, which is some money you can tap to have some flexibility. Maybe you don't want to be working for 5 more years. If you have this home that then says to you, you must work full time for the next 5 years, Well, that means at age 65 or 66, you actually have a fair amount of stress.
And again, you know, Kathleen, you talked about opportunity cost earlier on. And, you know, the cost of owning a house is way, way more than that monthly mortgage payment.
As you know very well, Tess.
You have to fix your plumbing. You have to fix your roof. You know, it adds up over and over and over again.
All right. Well, thank you very, very much.
Thanks so much for the call, Kathleen. I don't know, Chris, was I too negative on home ownership?
No, but you're cracking me up. I wanted to ask you, okay, so as you were rattling through the roof and the various other things about, I was going, okay, this is not just something that she's read or
no,
she's
not
heard.
Just off
this
the top
is
of my
experience.
Head. Within 6 months of moving into our house, we had refrigerator problems, we had stove problems, and we had a tree fall down in our backyard.
And you just put all that money down?
Yep.
Oh.
But,
I mean,
I love owning a home. But it is expensive.
It's expensive. This is not a knock against home ownership.
Not at
but
all.
But it's being realistic about what are the costs and what is your time frame.
Exactly. Well, if you've got a question, do let us know about it. Our voicemail is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks a lot.
And do remember to talk to your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. Your calls to our inbox, Mail Lady and Senior Producer Deb Clark is here. Hey, it's been a while.
It has. I know things have been piling up in mail land. I was all set to do it last week and then I lost my voice.
Yeah, you sounded like a 12-year-old boy going through puberty.
Oh, God, thank you.
So given what we talked about a few minutes ago, how much did you spend trying to fight that cold?
Well, actually, believe it or not, nothing. But that's only because I've spent so much over time that I have shelves filled with just about every remedy known to man. Anyway, enough about me. Let's talk about you.
Okay.
Or your interview with Nick Bilton.
Oh, right. Yeah. The New York Times writer and the author of the book, I Live in the Future, and Here is How It Works.
Yeah. A lot of people like this one, I think. And several people wrote in, including Nancy Clemens from Roseville, Minnesota. She said, she was concerned that face-to-face communication was becoming more difficult as so many spend time living in simulated worlds and techno games. Hmm. She did say, though, that she was fascinated by technology nonetheless.
Good point, I suppose.
Yeah. Now, Brian Burke from Santa Monica enjoyed the interview. He said it was all just a bit of malarkey.
Look, it's got links, real links. And video games are really just narratives. That's got to be good, right? You know, Hamlet, Lear, Grand Theft Auto, it's all the same. And Call of Duty 2 is a history lesson. As far as the book's title, doesn't that sound a bit audacious? I mean, despite all of his braggadocio, Nick Bilton still lives among us, and the future is yet to be.
Of course, if it wasn't yet to be, it wouldn't be the future, right?
Oh, you're getting all meta on me.
Yes, that's me, meta. Anyway, another attention getter was Jeff Tyler's story about the crush of fundraising solicitations at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Many people did not like us calling them junk mail.
Well, come on. How about that lady who got like 800 solicitations in 1 year? That's ridiculous.
Well, Sarah Schacht said she laughed out loud when she heard the story.
At that moment, I was writing an email to supporters of the organization I direct. And the subject title was, "This is not a fundraising letter. It's an update." And like most nonprofits, I don't view our supporters as ATMs. I view them as partners in getting our often difficult work done. Thanks for a great story and capturing the end-of-the-year madness in the nonprofit world.
I suppose they wouldn't do it if it didn't work, right? So somebody must be responding to those things.
That's true. I think Jeff said that, too. Another hot-button topic was the interview you did about buying divorce insurance.
We are such romantics on this show.
I know. So here's a couple of comments from our Facebook page. Nancy Hammer said, "I think marriage licenses should have to be renewed every 4 years. That would be the cheaper way to go."
Yeah, here's my favorite, though. Mary Stockton Bradley asked, "Can I take out a policy on someone else's marriage?"
Ouch. I don't think she's a friend of mine. Okay, so let's end with another story we ran last week. Reporter Eve Trode talked about trying to find a meaningful job in this recession, not just any old job.
But who can really afford to be picky, right?
Well, and that's sort of what Venice Battle of Philadelphia had to say.
I believe people are supposed to find their purpose in life, so finding a purpose-driven career is just a part of the game. Its feasibility, however, seems harder to attain every month. Bills need to get paid and people have to eat. Deciding between any random opportunity or waiting for one's dream job puts people I know and love between a rock and a hard place. Sometimes I wonder if dream jobs, like houses, comprise part of the vanishing American dream.
Hmm. Well, speaking of vanishing, time for me to do just that.
Thanks, Deb.
You're welcome, Tess.
And let us have it, folks. Post on our Facebook page or go to marketplace.org/money. The U.S. financial system can be dizzying and so time-consuming for most of us. And it's even worse for immigrants who are trying to navigate it. One solution for them can be found in California. It essentially serves as a mall of nonprofits. All of them are dedicated to providing financial education and assistance to Latinos. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
I'm standing in the lobby of Plaza Adelante on a Monday afternoon. People are hustling through this three-story building in one of San Francisco's best-known Latino neighborhoods.
¿Quieres un chocolate?
Carmina Valdez owns a gift shop in a small market on the ground floor of the building.
Este negocio es como mi bebé.
This business is like my baby. I have to nurture it, but I also have to make sure it has a future.
This business might not be here today without the help of the nonprofit organizations that set up shop in this former furniture store and warehouse. Upstairs, a peer lending organization helped Valdez get an interest-free loan. Down the hall, a small business specialist mentors her. And on the floor below, there's the computer center that loaned her a laptop so she can track her expenses and promote her shop on social networks.
Aquí está la página en Facebook.
Here it is, the page in Facebook. It's called Wrap Your Dreams. I already have lots of friends.
Valdez is one of thousands of Latinos who've gotten help at this one-stop shop for financial services since it opened 8 months ago.
Yo me siento así, como que todo el edificio fuera mi familia.
I feel like this whole building is my family. It's the first time that an organization has taken the time and wants to support us as Latinos.
The man who brought all these nonprofits together under one roof is Luis Granados. He's the executive director of the Mission Economic Development Agency. His organization paid more than $9 million to buy the building and turn it into a financial resource center for Latino immigrants.
I often hear them talk about how, is this place for us? Really for us? And like, they can't believe that such a nice space is actually dedicated to them.
When you walk into a social service center, all you see is sort of failures around you.
Claudia Vieck runs a statewide network of microlenders.
When you walk into Plaza Adelante, what you see is success around you.
The nonprofits at Plaza Adelante refer clients to each other. People don't have to run around town getting legal advice here or financial advice there. They only need to climb a flight of stairs. And they can drop their kids at the daycare on the way up.
Location, location, location is everything.
Jesse Gonzalez is the executive director of Caminos, the computer center that loaned Carmina Valdez her laptop. He says the nonprofits at Plaza Adelante can save money by sharing expenses on everything from copy machines to accountants. They could also throw joint fundraisers.
When somebody has an event, it's an event for everyone, so everybody benefits.
The idea of bringing a variety of services under one roof isn't new. There are nearly 200 nonprofit centers in the U.S., but typically they bring together social service or community development organizations. China Brodsky is managing director of Tide Shared Spaces, which sets up nonprofit centers. She says Plaza Adelante is one of a kind.
I don't know of any others that do what they're doing.
Brodsky says Plaza Adelante has already inspired a group of day laborers in Denver to organize a similar center.
Especially in this economy, a building that's really focused on wealth creation and financial literacy for immigrant Latinos is just something that's incredibly needed, and there aren't a lot of other options that these people have.
So it allows someone like Carmina Valdez to go in looking for a small business loan and come out with the small business itself.
Si no hay Plaza Adelante, no hay mercadito.
Without Plaza Adelante, there wouldn't be this market, and I wouldn't have this business.
She says someday she hopes her gift shop will help her pay her way through business school. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace Money.
So how many of you living in the Midwest or along the Eastern Seaboard checked on flights to Southern California this week? You should have. It was gorgeous. And of course, booking your own travel is a snap these days. Just head on over to Travelocity or Orbitz or Kayak, do a little comparison shopping, and hey, you're done. But there's a kink in that system now. American Airlines is taking their ball and going home. The carrier recently announced it will no longer list fares on the popular travel site Orbitz. Then Expedia dropped them. So there! Now, American is not the only airline doing this, so we asked George Hobica of AirfareWatchdog.com to help us figure out what this means for the world of DIY booking. George, welcome aboard.
Thanks, Tess.
So as someone who has very much enjoyed booking my own flights and doing the research myself, boy, that didn't last long.
No, I think we're going back to the 1970s when you had to call every airline separately.
Seriously. So why is this happening? Give us a rundown.
It's pretty simple. American Airlines just reported not very stellar financial results. And the reason they're not doing that well is because they have the highest costs in the industry. So they need to cut costs and they need to raise ancillary revenue. So if you book a ticket on Travelocity, let's say, and you'll notice that you never get a chance to buy the American Airlines credit card or to upgrade your seat or do all the other things. The only thing you actually ever get a chance to do is maybe buy insurance. But guess what? Travelocity is selling you that insurance product.
At this point, there are only a couple of airlines that have basically told the aggregators to go fly a kite, but they all tend to mimic each other eventually. Does this mean the death of these aggregators?
Well, I'm not sure it means the death as far as all travel, but it may mean that airfares are not going to be distributed in the same way as in the past. Now, Southwest hasn't had their fares on third-party sites for years. And in fact, I think American Airlines is looking at Southwest's success and thinking, well, Southwest is making a lot of money. American isn't. Southwest doesn't share their fares with third-party sites. So maybe American is actually copying Southwest.
Or maybe Southwest just has better service.
Well, that's one way to look at it. They have very friendly flight attendants who tell jokes and they don't charge for the first and second bag.
What does this mean then for those of us who've been using these services? Are we actually going to go back to travel agents?
Well, you know, travel agents are sometimes your best friends. You know, there are many, many reasons why you might want to use a travel agent. One good example is something called the code share. That's when airline A buys seats on airline B, but they're vastly different prices. For example, Delta might buy seats on Alitalia and sell New York to Rome for $1,000, but on Alitalia, it's $500. A travel agent would tell you that. They'd say, well, you know, it's the same flight, but it's vastly different airfares. And if you only go to Delta.com, you're only going to see the higher fare. So it's going to make it much more difficult for consumers to compare. And in fact, we're seeing that people are going back to travel agents, you know, the bricks and mortar travel agent on the quarter.
It seems so counterintuitive in this day and age, though, that you would have this kind of consumer control just snatched away from you, because in so many other aspects, we have become the decision makers and the comparison shoppers.
It is a step backwards for sure, Tess. But however, there are many airlines now that don't sell their tickets on third-party sites. Southwest.com is one. There's an airline called Allegiant Airlines, a little airline that's growing called Vision Airlines, again, only sells its tickets.
But those are smaller airlines except Southwest.
That's true, but they're making money. And some of the airlines weren't making money. You know, the other thing, too, is that airlines have, for years now, have been trying to drive traffic to their own websites through nefarious means, such as promo codes. For example, right now there's a promo code on Air France, 10% off on any ticket if you go to airfrance.com. You're not going to see that on Kayak. You're not going to see that on Priceline. So I think this is a trend that's been going on for a long time.
This has just got to mean that fares are going to be higher.
People are going to pay more for airfares. And that is the whole point. I mean, American Airlines wants to get higher fares.
And they're not pretending that there's another reason behind it.
Well, they kind of do. They say it's a better experience for the consumer. You know, in some respects it is, because you can do a one-stop shop. You can buy your seat upgrade. You can buy other products.
Right.
But I think the world is going to be a sadder place without online travel agencies. It's just not going to be as convenient. And people are going to end up paying more money.
George Hobica is the founder of AirfareWatchdog.com, and he's joined us from New York to talk about the new developments in not getting a great deal on airfares. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
I can't begin to tell you how many questions we get here about retirement. Seems much of our adult lives is spent just getting to the point where we don't have to work anymore. But when we ask what these folks plan to do when they stop working, it always surprises me how many people haven't really thought about it. They're going to retire, but they have no idea what that means. Well, this year, the first wave of baby boomers starts turning 65. And for those who really aren't sure what their retirement future looks like, Tracy Samuelson would like to introduce you to someone.
Bonnie Boatman used to be able to tell people at cocktail parties that she was a managing director at Bank of America. Then she retired, and she wasn't quite sure what to do with herself. She got a puppy.
Louie, come.
And while she was excited to retire at 55, she also found herself pining for the old days when she happened to pass Bank of America's offices. Her pre-retirement life was 95% work, 5% family.
I had no hobbies. And while it sounds like it would be really, really easy and fun and, oh, I'll just go do what interests me, it's actually pretty daunting to fill up that time. Well, not to fill it up, but to get it right, to get it so that you feel like you're intellectually stimulated and not just doing stuff.
Before she retired, Bank of America signed Boatman up with a company in Boston called New Directions. Charging anywhere from $10,000 to $30,000, it counsels executives through transitions. And with so many boomers fast approaching retirement, that increasingly means helping people figure out what on earth they want to do when they leave their jobs. For Boatman, that means singing in a chorus and sitting on three boards, two nonprofit and one corporate. And she's learning to country fiddle.
To tell somebody this story that you actually wanted me to play the violin is going to be worth its weight in gold.
But even with New Directions' help, Boatman says it took her 4 years to finally feel like she had her retirement right. Sam Pease, a counselor at New Directions, says this is par for the course.
We've had numerous stories of people coming here after 6 months of golf and saying, my handicap's only going down one stroke and I'm bored to tears. People find out that quote-unquote retirement isn't what it's cracked up to be.
Historically, retirement was sort of like an on-off switch. You were working and then you stopped. But now it's not so simple. Baby boomers are taking a more step-down approach, transitioning from their main careers to so-called encore careers. That might mean a position in a new field or more meaningful work with flexible hours.
I've got too much energy to be on the sidelines.
Phil Lucier is a New Directions client thinking about an encore career. At 55, he left his job as a CEO when the financial services company he worked for was acquired by ING. After 2 years of travel, volunteering, and golf, he wants to get back to work. It's retirement, he says, redefined.
I like the competing in the marketplace, and the reality is I'm not done competing. So how can I do that, and how's the way to go about doing that in the current economic environment?
He credits Sam Pease, the New Directions counselor, with broadening his options.
Sam helped me think about not only what do I want to do now in my next immediate role in working, but what would I want to do longer term over 10, 15, 20 years.
Lucier calls New Directions a good investment. He's paying for the counseling himself. But in the current economy, many can't afford to pay thousands for retirement counseling.
So welcome this morning to the relaunch Circle 3.
Last class, we had a whole discussion about content, control, compensation, and culture.
Lisa Chernofsky-Singer is a certified life coach in New York. She's speaking to half a dozen clients of a company called iRelaunch, helping them to figure out how to transition back into the workforce after time off.
In some respects, your relaunch should be probably not that dissimilar to when you first started out of grad school where you want to start exploring again.
Vivian Steer-Rabin is one of the company's founders. She estimates more than a third of her clients are retired boomers looking to go back to work.
We're definitely seeing more people who are motivated financially than before because, quite frankly, people's nest eggs took a hit and they're being realistic about the need to potentially bring in more income.
iRelaunch charges $350 for a package of 4 counseling sessions. But there might be an even cheaper option. Counselors say that future generations could limit the need for counseling if they simply don't let work become their entire identity. Interests outside the office? What a novel idea. In Boston, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace Money.
And finally, time for our weekly version of a stick-up, where we walk up to you and ask you to hand over your wallet. So we can see what's inside.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pockets.
Because
Because of your giant wallet. Just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Andre Daniel. I live in Oakland, and we are at the Oakland Farmers Market in Old Town Oakland near Chinatown. Inside my wallet is usually not very much except for cash and identification and one debit card. Normally, or over the years, I have preferred to use cash. It seems more direct. It somehow seems a little bit more personal. I know that sounds a little silly. Let me see. My wallet is pretty standard. It's black and nylon. It is different because it has the South African flag knit into one of the sides. This actually isn't my usual wallet. A friend of mine who was my roommate, he left the wallet when he went traveling to South Africa and to Kenya. I did some traveling in the last few months and so picked up this because I think it just represented sort of traveling. Inside the wallet are just a few items that are reminders. One is actually a friend's number for her alarm, because I have some of my possessions stored in her home. So to turn the alarm on or off, I need to remember the code. And then I have my brother's address. Their home is in Miami, Florida. It's a long address, and I often need to remember it. Inside the left pouch, in sort of a clear case, I have my friend Megan's business card in here, because I guess you could say girlfriend. I guess that's how we refer. But when I was traveling, I wanted a reminder of her and of home.
Janae Darden got this wallet open for us. And she reports that if Andre sounded a little nervous at the end, it's because his new girlfriend was standing right there. You can do more wallet peeping at marketplace.org/money and tell us your wallet stories on our Facebook page. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, keeping secrets about what you spent your money on.
Maybe it's a little bit lying because you're hiding it from them. Because I do know that when I purchase a new bag, I do kind of feel guilty. And I feel like, gosh, how am I going to show this to my husband? So I do hide it, and I won't bring it out for a little while. And sometimes he won't notice.
If you've ever hidden a purchase from your spouse, you'll want to hear this one. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Special thanks this week to our good friends here at Oregon Public Broadcasting. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering strategies for investors seeking both returns and lower volatility. On the web at putnam.com/absolute return.
American Public Media.